Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
Nasty, brutish, and sure, and human beings are basically wolves at each other's throats, then we're going to end up with a certain picture of politics. If we believe that human beings are capable of dignity and needing dignity and respect, then we end up in a different place. And that's the place I choose to begin my thinking from. And that changes a lot, and doesn't mean that I think human beings can do terrible things, but those things are explicable in terms of the lamentable situations in which they find themselves.
Don't tell me how many black friends you have. Don't tell me you are married to someone of colour. Don't tell me you voted for Obama. As you reap comfort for being white, we suffer from being black and people of colour. But your comfort is linked to our pain and suffering. The powerful words of American philosopher George Yancey from his essay Dear White America, published in the New York Times philosophy series, The Stone. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Are human beings getting better? And do we need religion to live an ethical life? Well, on tonight's show, we're going to tackle those questions with British philosopher, writer and teacher Simon Critchley, whose latest book, Modern Ethics and 77 Arguments, A Stone Reader, has just been published by W.W. Norton & Company, where Simon argues, faith is not a like-for-like relationship of equals, but the asymmetry of the like-to-unlike. It is a subjective strength that only finds its power to act through an admission of weakness. Simon goes on to state, it is perhaps the faithless who can best sustain the rigour of fate, without requiring security, guarantees and rewards. So, what does it mean to be an ethical person? And why is doubt so important?
So, I'm Simon Critchley. I teach philosophy at the New School for Social Research in New York. I've written a lot of books on different things, and I also run or moderate a column with the New York Times, a philosophy column with the New York Times called The Stone.
Really well done on Modern Ethics, Simon. I have to say it's very interesting read, very stimulating parts, very troubling in other parts. You present so many different ethical dilemmas to the reader, and the range of contributors, I have to say, is something else. There is such a range there, and I think there's something there for everybody. I might throw you a big wide open question to kick things off, and we can take it from there. Do you think ethics are valued in society today? What do you think?
That's a big question. Yes, they are. Yeah, everybody thinks that they're moral. I mean, in terms of their, you know, people in the way people act socially, the way people represent people politically, people think that they're, for the most part, doing good. The question is whether that is good or not, and that's a more philosophical question. So I think it's a fact about the vast, vast majority of human beings that they believe they're acting morally in their lives. The question of whether that morality is legitimate or not is a second-order question that philosophers and different people ask. So, but I think, yeah, people for the most part think they're doing well, and then, you know, then there are blind spots where we discover all sorts of things that we think are good are actually causing unintentional kinds of wrongdoing and maliciousness.
Well, how do you define ethics, or what does it mean to live an ethical life? Like, what? How does that all work out for you?
Well, I mean, you know, for as long as human beings have been living in groups since whenever, but then certainly since the rise of what we think of as civilization, the cities of the Middle East, there have been habits, there have been beh- behaviors. And so the idea of ethics is linked. It goes back to the old ancient Greek word for a behavior, a habit, a custom, and ethos. And so all human life is ethical in that sense. It's composed of different habits and customs. And those customs, by definition, vary from place to place. There are different customs in the city of, you know, Babylon from the city of Nineveh or Jerusalem or whatever. And then the question, the philosophical question, I guess, is the question of, you know, of who's right and of what a legitimate morality would consist in. So ethics is a general feature of human life wherever human beings gather. That doesn't mean that they're right, but they just believe. Usually they inhabit the customs, they inherit and inhabit the customs of the place in which they live. Are those customs good customs? Well, that's a more philosophical question.
But why do you think it is, though, Simon, that some people find it so difficult to take an ethical position on something that may be either troubling them in some way or something that they see in the news or whether it's kind of a right to life issue, that they just don't like either committing to a position or they don't like having a definite stance in it?
Well, that could be because they're being, you know, they might be being, acting out of fear. They don't know what to think, or they're secretly, they have a moral, you know, conviction which they're not, they think is something that they're not able to express publicly, or they could just be, you know, uncertain about what the right thing is to do. So for example, things like the right to life, things like the death penalty, these general questions, there might be, you know, a conviction we have, a belief that we have, which we're not sure whether that's the right thing to do. I mean, I mean, my personal view is that when it comes to moral questions, the thing we have to be careful about is forms of certainty. You know, when people believe they're morally certain about something, then that might be fine, but it also might be the perpetuation of an unjust practice. So kind of what happens with when philosophy comes on the scene. And this is a good way of thinking about it. You know, with the ancient Greeks 2,500 years ago, I mean, those peoples in Greece, those cities, each had their customs, their practices, their ways of life, their different conceptions of what is good. And then Socrates came along, and he asked the question, you know, what is virtue in general? What is goodness in general? And that leads you to raise the question, well, is what is good in a one context good in another context? Can there be a goodness which can be valid, can be legitimate across different contexts? And you know, that's one thing that many people believe is the importance of, say, constitutions, things like the European Court on Human Rights, legislation like that. Regardless of what individual people might think in terms of their prejudices, there has to be an idea of goodness and legitimacy, which is codified in law and which is binding on different peoples and groups. So that's kind of the way things run.
So where have you maybe changed your mind on ethical views or ethical positions? Or are you open to changing your mind when you possibly get new information or you go through maybe a life experience that possibly would change how you perceive a certain issue or change how you understand things?
Yeah, I mean, I think it happens more rarely than we might think, you know, but it does happen. I think you can look at, take the example of Ireland and the way Ireland has shifted in terms of public opinion on things like homosexuality, gay marriage, within a generation, a couple of generations. That's a moral change, and people have changed their minds. How has that happened? That's happened for different reasons. In cases like that, you can point at, maybe even something like moral progress. Other cases, I mean, it's hard to shift people's basic assumptions about their basic moral assumptions about the world, and it might take something really dramatic to do that. I know of there's a philosopher I used to read called Bernard Williams, and he was talking about fact that philosophers never change their minds. In his experience, they're rather dogmatic people, which is a pity. But he was talking about being on a government commission once, looking at issues of paedophilia and child pornography, and whether there should be legislation in Britain on child pornography. And this philosopher who was on this committee didn't think there should be legislation. And when he saw the evidence of child pornography, actually confronted with it for a day or a series of days, changed his mind. So that can also happen. There can be events in the world that lead to a sudden shift in one's moral perspective. Other examples, say like homosexuality, there can be a gradual shift over a generation. So, but basically people tend to cling to their moral view of the world, the one that they've inherited, the one that they were told was right when they were growing up, and it's hard to break with that.
You have some remarkable essays in this collection, and they're so deeply affecting, tackling so many really tricky questions in political, social and economic life. Possibly one of the ones that really stuck out for me was Sheila Benhab's piece on the morality of migration. And she argues that the morality and politics of migration are amongst the most divisive issues in the world today. And she says migratory movements are sites of imperfect justice. I thought that was so brilliantly put. But when we think about what's happening all across Africa and the Middle East, when women and children are getting on boats and, you know, they're in positions, desperate positions, and how vulnerable they are. Yet there's countries all across Europe who are adamant not to take them. So I'm just wondering, what's an appropriate or moral response to all of that? Or what's your philosophical response to all of that?
Well, it depends what your moral view of things is, right? I mean, the leaders of a country, a government, see themselves as having duties and obligations only, or primarily towards their own citizens, or whether they see themselves as having duties and obligations towards citizens from other places. And in many ways, the conflicts that are defining the world as we speak are conflicts around questions of migration and what we owe to migrants, to refugees, to people that are making a claim to come to usually where we are, and what our responsibilities to them, those people are. And, Sheila Benhabib in her essay is basically arguing for a position that's informed by the work of Immanuel Kant, who in many ways is maybe the most important moral thinker of the modern period. Kant has an idea of what he calls a universal right of hospitality. So to be a citizen of a country doesn't mean that one's obligations are only to other citizens, but there are also obligations to people from elsewhere, citizens of other places. There's a hospitality that refugees and migrants have, and that's this raises the question, the huge question about borders and. What's happened, if we think about the European context, but obviously also the United States, it's, does one admit people that are making a claim to, or just expressing a wish to be in that place? What policy should a government adopt, and what should the feelings of, what might the feelings of ordinary citizens be in those situations? And I think, what's emerged in the last years, really in very recent years, we forget that with the rise of populism in different parts of the world, has been an aggressive reassertion of borders, and people now through their politicians are able to give voice to an extraordinary hostility towards migrants, which people like me think is immoral. That's not a morally justified position. So I think Shayla's arguing that position too. So could we, if we think about, this is what's really depressing at the moment. I mean, migratory movements are sites of imperfect justice, yeah. But, under a president like Obama. That question was, you know, a very different question than it is under President Trump and the kind of vigorous reassertion of nationalism. And the, you know, and so the question, you know, the larger question which you raised before in are human beings getting better, is, I think, is a very difficult question to answer. If you look at the broad historical sweep, it, you know, the kind of the jury is out. Yes, in many ways, yes. But, you know, what's happened in recent years really is really deeply troubling, that, you know, people are being allowed by politicians to give expression to moral views which would be exclusionary. And that's profoundly worrying, I think. And does that indicate a shift in people's moral perspectives, or are they just being allowed to give voice to things they've always thought? I don't know, those are things we could talk about.
It also makes you wonder, have people learned from their history and some of the horrendous things that have happened through history? And based on that, things become very grim, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the essays in the volume, a lot of the essays that we've done in the Stone over the years, in the New York Times, offer a historical perspective. So there's a series of pieces in the book on the question of race, and a piece in particular I think you liked called "Dear White America" by George Yancey. And what's going on there is really, you know, if you look at the question of race from a historical perspective, then your views have to be checked and changed. And I think the terrible thing is whether people remember or forget. And if they forget, then the worst can happen again. There's a piece that I wrote in the book, which I guess is my favorite piece in the favorite piece that I've written in the book, on the dangers of certainty, because it's about this extraordinary man, Jacob Bronowski, who a scientist and also worked on literature, but did this extraordinary television series called The Ascent of Man in 1973. And it's the story of the rise of modern science. It's a fascinating kind of television documentary on that history. But he ends up in Auschwitz. And he gives this extraordinary speech, standing in a kind of muddy pool in Auschwitz. And can I read a little bit of it, of Bronowski?
Love to, yeah.
Yeah, because he says this. This is really, really, it really says what I want to say. He says that it's said that science will dehumanize people and turn them into numbers. That's false, tragically false. Look for yourself. This is the concentration camp and crematorium at Auschwitz. This is where people were turned into numbers. Into this pond were flushed the ashes of some 4 million people. And that was not done by gas. That was done by arrogance. It was done by dogma. It was done by ignorance. When people believe they have absolute knowledge with no test in reality, this is how they behave. This is what men do when they aspire to the knowledge of gods. And he basically pleads in this moment for the lesson of a scientific picture of the world, which is a lesson about knowledge. And knowledge is something which is fallible, which accrues over time, which develops, but it's always pushing at the edges of the unknown. It's always an adventure into something which we don't yet know. And he wants to make a distinction between that and forms of certainty, and in particular, moral certainty. And the problem that, I think many of the problems that we encounter morally is that people believe that they're kind of morally certain about things because of their upbringing, their background. And what knowledge can produce, in particular historical knowledge, is it can produce factually based stories which contradict and refute those certainties, and force people to revise their histories and their view of things, and also to revise their moral sense. I think that's what I see as the kind of the philosophical and intellectual task, is to offer those kinds of perspectives. It's hard to do because people, not just that people forget, but people are, you know, in the present context, are being encouraged to forget, actively encouraged to forget, and to work on the basis of their worst, most thoughtless prejudices. And that will lead us to disaster.
I'm just wondering, Simon, what's your own view of the death penalty? There's a case recently of two British citizens. I think they're called the Beatles. They're an ISIS cell. And they're now going to be formally put through the legal system in America and possibly are facing the death penalty. But they've done the most hideous and horrendous acts. They have taken part in public executions where they filmed it and put it up on YouTube. So they have clearly are incredibly ugly acts. But ultimately, they're also people who should be treated with dignity and respect and the full rigours of the law. And part of that law are principles of human rights. So I'm just wondering where you stand in it all, because I was thinking about the case last night. And you know what I mean? These guys have clearly have done terrible, brutal, disgusting things. But we have to, if we have to bring about progress in society and, you know, make society a better place for all, we have to make sure at the centre that it's human rights and human values.
Yes, I mean, and if our standards are simply a reflection of the same standards of a group like ISIS, then we're in the same moral quagmire as them. I mean, ISIS are a group based on a kind of, you know, having a resurgent moment. They're, you know, obviously they've lost a huge amount of land, but there's still a presence in places like Libya and Niger and across the Middle East. But based on a grotesque distortion of Islam, and based upon a very the grotesqueness of that distortion is based upon an idea of us versus them. And if you're not one of us, namely one of their very limited idea of what it means to be Muslim, then you're one of them, and you can be treated accordingly. You can be enslaved, you can be killed, and so on and so forth. And yeah, we know that. Now, if we act in the same way with the same retributive idea of justice towards people who've conducted those crimes, then we're no better, it seems to me. And the death penalty, I think, is a case in point. And if there were, you know, if there were votes on the death penalty, certainly in the U.S., it's still used in many, many states. And in Britain, if there were vote on the death penalty, I'm sure it would win widespread popular support, but that doesn't mean it's right. And I think that the death penalty is a horrendous, vengeful act, and it's an idea of morality which is really rooted in revenge. You know, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. And it seems to me that the first principle of any morality has to be that we, although we might in certain occasions want to take someone's life, or we might feel violent feelings towards them, we don't act in those ways. And that's what law guided by moral intuitions can provide us with in the frame of things like human rights legislation. So I feel deeply that the death penalty is a terrible thing, and what the British government is doing in the case that you mentioned with these two guys is cynically pandering to the worst aspects of the right in the Conservative Party and in UKIP and the rest, in order to turn a blind eye to the treatment of these two people who were British citizens, in order to wash their hands of them, because they know that if they're judged within the US, then there's a good chance that they will be they'll be killed. So it's an act of pretty grotesque cynicism, I think, on the part of the British government.
Simon, I loved Christine Overall's essay, Think Before You Breed. She argues choosing whether or not to have children is the most significant ethical debate of most people's lives. Now, I don't have children, but I can see exactly where she's going with that.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, the great thing about the Stone and doing this work with the New York Times is that, I mean, some of the people in the book I know, quite a lot of people I know, but a lot of the people I don't know, and people just turned up over the years. So Christina, I've never met, she just turned in a piece and we worked on it, and then it came out, gosh, it was a good few years ago, around 2012. And I mean, the question she raises, it got a huge amount of readers. It was, because it's such a interesting question, the question whether you should have children or not. And I think the point that she's making is that morally, as it were, when people, the way we tend to see things for the most part is that if someone decides not to have children, then we require some explanation from them. Oh, why did you not have children? But if you have children, you just have children. And she's asking us to think about the question, why should you have children? What's going on with that? And I'd like to put that together with another piece that you mentioned also, which is by Peter Singer, very famous Australian philosopher, which is towards the end of the book, called Should This Be the Last Generation? And he raises a similar question, you know, which is if the evidence of climate change and all the rest is true, and human beings are doing what they appear to be doing to the planet, then what is the argument for reproduction? Why should one continue the species? And I think the in both those cases, I think it's a question of raising that issue is a moral question that should be reflected on. I mean, neither of them are arguing for a kind of that we should just stop breeding, but they're asking us to think carefully about that. And I think that's an issue that it's a moral issue that I think people think about in a very everyday way. I mean, you can meet someone, fall in love, you know, move in together, then decide you want to have children, and that seems like a kind of morally decent thing to do. But in the context of the world as it now stands, is that the right thing to do? Is that going to be a net benefit to humanity, or is that going to add to the, you know, ongoing catastrophe? And I think that a lot of people ponder that question. I think it's a difficult question to answer.
It's an interesting question, you know, and it's possibly one that will be continually asked in the next 100 to 200 years. And possibly some people would find it very heavy duty now. And certainly if you went out to dinner tonight and, you know, you started elaborating on your moral position on whether to have kids or not and how climate change affects it all and population explosions, somebody would probably think that you need to be put in a straitjacket. But ultimately, right, 200 years' time, this will be a massive question when we look at issues of climate change, refugees, you look at issues related to water levels, climate wars and all of that, and resource wars. It'll become more affecting.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's no question about that. I think the scarce resources of the earth, we have those to ponder, and I mean, if we just think about the experience of, I know it's been very, very warm in Ireland this summer, and you know, the effects of climate change, and we can experience that as a warm summer, which then reveals certain extraordinary archaeological remains and destroys crops and things like that. But the effects of that on the 7 billion people who live on planet Earth and growing, if you just begin to think that through, are devastating. There will be, so going back to Shayla Ben-Habib's essay about migration, I mean, one fact about the world is going to be the increased presence of migration. People are going to be moving from one place to another. So therefore, the demands that are going to be made on places which are relatively stable, like the countries of, say, Western Europe, are going to grow and grow as the years pass. And, you know, and that then raises the question, well, isn't having kids just contributing to the problem and not the solution. I think that's something that people should think and think through. The philosophical point is it's not just an unquestioned good to have children. Right? It has to be thought about philosophically and to be a much more coherently justified decision than just to say, well, I'm going to do this. It's a good thing to do.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I'm talking with British philosopher, writer and teacher Simon Critchley, whose latest offering, Modern Ethics in 77 Arguments, has just been published by W.W. Norton. I asked Simon about Carl Cederstrom's essay on The Dangers of Happiness, where Carl argues, be wary when politicians suggest that happiness be made the ultimate aim for society. We should remember that they are probably not talking about happiness at all. They are talking about ideology.
Carl is great. He's an old friend of mine, and he's Swedish, and Sweden is a wonderful example of a country where morality and government have been much more kind of deeply interwoven and a very kind of utilitarian idea of morality and the idea that happiness is something which governments can kind of organize. And he talks in the essay about the former Prime Minister of Britain, David Cameron's sudden interest in the question of happiness. And that goes back to an idea that happiness is something that can be measured right? You can quantify the greatest happiness of the greatest number. That's the moral view of Jeremy Bentham. That's called utilitarianism, and it's the business of government to make people happy or make people less happy. But then that raises the question, you know, what is happiness, and is happiness something we should be aiming for? I mean, you know, and then, what do we mean by happiness? Once you begin to ask that question, so I think what he's attacking is the ideology of happiness, that we assume we know what happiness is. We can ask people whether they're happy or not, and then statistically we can put that together into a survey and reach the remarkable conclusion that people in a certain country are happy, or the Danes are the happiest people in the world, or whatever. It's, from a philosophical point of view, nonsense, and it doesn't really begin to even explore the question, you know, what is happiness exactly?
And surely we should be looking more at issues in relation to meaning and purpose, because that's much more relevant to anyone's daily experience of life. And within that, possibly you can veer into happiness. But really, you know, if you're building a just and equal society, then those citizens in it are have purpose, find meaning, and within that, hope and all of that. Happiness is not necessarily where it's at in terms of how we're all living.
Absolutely, I think you know the. If we think about, you know, if you ask someone, are you happy? They're going to say, well, yes or no, but that's going to be based on some question. Well, how are you feeling at this moment? You know, what do you feel good? Do you feel less good? So happiness is reduced to this idea of a kind of relatively transient feeling. If you reach further back, and this is where you know history is the great educator, happiness, say again, for our friends the ancient Greeks, meant something like flourishing. It meant something like, or the actual word in Greek means well-godded, or being, you know, being blessed by the gods. Eudaimonia is the word, but flourishing. And if we think about that question, you know, are you flourishing? Are human beings flourishing? That means that the question of happiness cannot be isolated from questions of the broader meaning and purpose of life in society. The problem, so what the question of happiness reveals is the fact that we've reduced happiness to a question of individual feeling, whereas it should be a question of wider social flourishing and what the meaning and purpose of that flourishing might be.
William Irwin's essay, God is a Question, Not an Answer, I thought was possibly one of the best ones in the collection. And it brings up so many different scenarios in your head to think about. But he says, you know, the question is permanent, answers are temporary. I live in the question. And it is such a wonderful way to look at life, isn't it, Simon?
Yeah, I think it's you know, we think of, there's a risk in looking at questions of God and questions of religion as offering forms of certainty, as I said before when I was talking about Bronowski. I think there is, for religious people that really interest me, that I think have really thought things through, what the experience of faith is something which is an experience of questioning and doubt. So when faith kind of contracts into a series of, into an experience of certainty, which underpins a series of moral certainties, then I think that's a very dangerous thing. God, is a question, not an answer. And God should be a space where we can explore what is most full of doubt and most uncertain about our lives. I think Bill Irwin in the essay talks about, there's a quotation from Nathaniel Hawthorne, says of the great writer Melville, Herman Melville, he can neither believe nor be comfortable in his unbelief, and he's too honest and courageous not to try to do one or the other. I think there's two things I think are very important to avoid. There's a certainty of belief on the one hand, exhibited in people like, say, members of ISIS. There's also a certainty of unbelief. There's a certain kind of, if you like, evangelical atheism that you can find in people that read a lot of Richard Dawkins and people like that. I think it's important to try to understand belief, the nature of faith, but not just be not to, you know, give oneself over to forms of certainty, and neither to be comfortable in one's unbelief, but to respect belief and faith when it's experienced, and to pursue it that way. So I think what Bill Irwin's trying to do there is to take on the idea of faith as a kind of certainty, and that's really what should be questioned. Faith is many things, but it's also an experience of doubt.
It's a lovely unfolding, if you will. I found your own piece on religion, The Rigour of Love, very interesting. And you talk about the faith of the faithless, and you bring up Kierkegaard and his iconic text, The Works of Love. Can you talk me through all of that?
Yeah, it was a long time ago. But it was, I mean, the question really goes back to the great Irish writer Oscar Wilde. It goes back to Oscar Wilde's De Profundis, and this text, De Profundis, that Wilde wrote when he was in Reading jail, is a profound meditation on belief, on faith, amongst other things. And Wilde asked the question of whether there could be what he calls a confraternity of the faithless, where a priest who wasn't really a priest with unconsecrated bread could initiate a kind of a communion amongst unbelievers. Can there be a faith of the faithless, a confraternity of the faithless, is the question that Wilde asked. And I'm very much concerned with that. What is really going on in the experience of faith? And so with Kierkegaard, this picks up on something I was saying before. Kierkegaard in The Works of Love is concerned with the insecurity of faith, that faith is a proclamation. It's a statement of belief, but it's not a kind of certainty. It means being open to the unbeliever, open to that person that can challenge you, and so faith is this experience of proclamation and commitment, which is at its core insecure. All it is a command, if you like, a command to believe. And what that's underpinned by, and this is what really interests me, is the experience of love. And really, what's going on in that? So, what interests me is the whether people who have no certainty when it comes to faith, no certainty in the existence of a God, can also experience some kind of faith, some kind of commitment, and how that's linked to the experience of love as that thing which binds together a self and allows it to empathize with other people. And that's really what I was trying to think through in relation to Kierkegaard. So on one level is, you know, Kierkegaard's a deeply Christian thinker, but on the other hand, he doesn't think there are many Christians in the world. Those people that call themselves Christians for Kierkegaard aren't really Christians. They're just existing within the dogmas and prejudices of the various national churches. And the actual experience of faith is something much more demanding and troubling. I think that's really what I'm trying to bring out in that paper, in that essay.
Todd May's Accepting the Past, Facing the Future ends the collection, and it's a powerful piece of writing on so many different levels, and it was a great choice. He asks his readers, what would we be willing to sacrifice of ourselves to prevent horrors now and in the future? It's a magnificent question, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's the question. Are we prepared to sacrifice our happiness, as it's understood, our temporary gratifications in order to secure a better future for those people, for those future generations. And obviously the jury is out on that issue. You know, I guess one thing I wanted to say, which is important to me, is that there's the philosophical tradition of moral thinking, moral philosophy, where we raise questions about the nature of morality. But the question which really, I think, is a question of ultimately faith or belief is whether we believe that human beings are fundamentally decent or not. And there are at least two schools of thought on that. There are people that think that human beings are fundamentally wicked, rapacious animals that need to be held in by law, and their behavior regulated by the police, and basically if human beings were allowed to act on their basic wishes, then it would be a war of all against all. And there are those people that believe that actually it's the other way around. It's law and the police that make things worse, and that human beings are basically decent, well-intentioned creatures that want dignity, respect, and don't find it in a world which denies it to them. And I'm in the latter camp. So I think that this is where something which is, I think, is a closer to a, if you like, a religious decision rather than a philosophical argument. Does one believe that human beings are fundamentally decent or not? I choose to believe they're fundamentally decent. So the question that Todd May asked in his piece is basically that: if we begin from an idea of decency and the capacity for decency, which I think is degraded in the societies in which we live, then can that be cultivated through education? He talks in particular about the Holocaust as an example, more than an example. Can they be educated in ways that allow them to think more thoughtfully, approach more thoughtfully issues of the future? And I think that's the task that faces us. If we believe that life is nasty, brutish, and sure, and human beings are basically wolves at each other's throats, then we're going to end up with a certain picture of politics. If we believe that human beings are capable of dignity and needing dignity and respect, then we end up in a different place. And that's the place I choose to begin my thinking from. And I think that changes a lot. And doesn't mean that I think human beings can do terrible things, but those things are explicable in terms of the lamentable situations in which they find themselves. But I think Todd May is a kind of, he doesn't mention it here, but he's a kind of anarchist in the way in which maybe I am too, in the sense in which anarchists believe that human beings are basically good and it's society that makes them bad. And the task of education is trying to allow those capacities for goodness to flourish, and that basically we want to get along, we want to behave decently towards each other, but we find ourselves in situations where that becomes hard to do, and where we're actively encouraged to do the opposite, and that's what has to be changed.
And that was British philosopher, writer and the Hans Jonas Professor of Philosophy at the New School for Social Research in New York, Simon Critchley. Modern Ethics and 77 Arguments is published by W.W. Norton and retails for just under €17 in paperback. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Okay, all that's left for me to do now is to say thank you for listening and a big shout out to the lovely Jojo on sound. We've been talking books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the words of the great Danish philosopher, poet and theologian Søren Kierkegaard, who once quipped, "Life is not a problem to be solved, but a reality to be experienced." How true. Good night.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.